This episode of Lost Cultures, Living Legacies from Travel and Leisure is brought to you by the Bermuda Tourism Authority.
I have a deep, deep love of the sea. Standing in Bermuda, looking out at the sea, it's huge. The sea and the sky merge together. It just feels like it goes on forever and that you're in the middle of nowhere. And then I learned to enjoy being in the middle of nowhere. And one of the things I have a great memory of growing up, and I still do to this day, is walking along the rocks. So in Bermuda, there are a number of wonderful railway trails where you can walk and ride and run, and a lot of them run by the sea. But our shoreline, where there aren't our beautiful pink sand beaches, are craggy rocks, really kind of volcanic rocks that came up as the island was being formed. And those are where some of my favorite memories are, jumping across rocks, looking in tide pools, snorkeling in front of my house, climbing across things that were probably slightly too high for us and being yelled at by fishermen, "You children, get down from there!" That freedom I felt because there were no walls or gates. It was just us kids in our church shoes and church dresses climbing across the rocks against the sea. I'm Dr. Christy Warren. I am first and foremost a Bermudian. I am someone who is really curious about the world around me, and I really think that Bermuda is a great place for exploring different curiosities.
Dr. Warren is a senior lecturer at the University of Lincoln in England who focuses on the histories of colonialism and slavery and their legacies within Bermuda, the Caribbean, and the United Kingdom.
Studying Bermuda started for me because I actually don't remember Bermuda first. I remember Slough in England. And my parents tell me that when they brought me here, just before I was about 3, that I threatened to walk back to Bermuda. So clearly, I loved it from the beginning. I just don't remember that bit. And we were here for 3 years. We went back home for a couple of years, then came back here for another year. And then I spent the rest of my childhood in Bermuda. Those few years made a big difference. And there were things about being Bermudian that I didn't get. And initially it frustrated me. And I was like, I don't understand this place. Nobody understands me. I just want to leave. And part of that was teenage angst, of course, in retrospect. But then something flipped. I studied history and English as an undergraduate. And it was very kind of standard European history. But I had an excellent history teacher. And for my extended essay, I wrote about Bermuda. I wrote about Bermudian history the best I could. So it was basically looking from Britain. And that was my first attempt to reconnect with my home and try and understand it. Like, what is this place that I come from? How does it connect to the UK? And what does it mean to be Bermudian and British at the same time? Because we're British subjects, always have been, more or less. And that's become my life's work.
What can we discover about a place by exploring the histories of those who once lived there and those who live there still? In what ways do cultures build upon each other as populations come and go? How do they complement each other, interact, and leave their marks on the people that come after them? And are cultures truly ever lost, even if the people move on or evolve and adapt? Welcome to Lost Cultures, Living Legacies, a podcast from Travel and Leisure. I'm your host, Alicia Prakash. Just as Dr. Warren was explaining, her best memories of Bermuda have to do very much with what and where it is, an island far out to sea where the ocean fades into the sky on a clear day. Of course, these days, many people travel to and from Bermuda by plane or motorized boat. But centuries ago, when neither of those were available, the geographical position of the island was of incredible importance to sailors as they made their way between Europe and the Americas aboard large sailing vessels with limited supplies, and they found themselves in need of a navigational touchpoint. But let's start a little further back.
I'm Dr. Edward Harris. I was born in Bermuda, and I returned to Bermuda, not intending to stay. in 1979 and began to work as the first director of the National Museum of Bermuda. It has to be appreciated that geographically, Bermuda was one of the very rare islands in the world that were not settled until Europeans took to the high seas with their new type of vessels invented in the 1400s in Northern Europe, which eventually were called galleons, and ships like that, which allowed them to sail the ocean seas. Prior to that, Bermuda was uninhabited because the Native Americans, North, South, and in the Caribbean, did not have sailing technology which allowed them to reach Bermuda. And because Bermuda lies 650 miles offshore of the closest point being Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, if you were lucky enough, if you had the sailing technology, say, for example, like a Polynesian outrigger canoe that would allow you to sail, say, from the Bahamas to Bermuda, first off, you had to be lucky to find it, and then secondly, you had to be able to get back. Well, in the first instance, they didn't have the sailing technology, and so Bermuda remained like Mauritius, Tristan da Cunha, St. Helena, a few other islands, untouched until Europeans took to the high seas. So Bermuda is one of those rare islands that were not settled until 500 odd years ago, that is to say 100,000 years after we left Africa as a human species. It took until 500 years ago for Bermuda and other places to be settled by people. So its geography has been very important to the development of its culture.
So when exactly did people first come in contact with the island, at least as far as we know?
The first known contact with Bermuda, as far as present knowledge goes, was in 1505 when a Spanish ship was on its way back to Spain and came across Bermuda in the North Atlantic. The usual sailing route, if you were coming out of the Caribbean Sea in the Gulf of Mexico or out of Cuba, was to sail north until you picked up the trade winds to blow you back to Southern Europe. And Bermuda straddles those trade winds. And so later on, of course, mariners like to see Bermuda on a good day, at which point they would then turn right to proceed back to Europe. Quite often they came across Bermuda in stormy weather or at night, and they turned to the right on the wrong side and then ended up on the extensive reefs. So Bermuda became a navigational beacon for shipping traffic out of the Caribbean Sea, Central America, and the Caribbean Sea in the North Atlantic. So again, its geographical position gave it an early importance, but it was unknown to the world until 1505, when it was seen by a Spanish pilot, Juan de Bermudez, from which Bermuda takes its name.
Let's examine for a moment one of the early ways in which sailors made use of Bermuda as it became a growing part of the network of settlements and colonies spreading across the Americas and the Caribbean. And how exactly did pigs fit into this?
So there was another century of sparse human contact with Bermuda. Most of the ships just liked to see it and then be on their way. Of course, the Spanish often put pigs overboard. Mr. Piggy is a very good swimmer, and the idea being that if your ship or one of your ships later on was shipwrecked, then you'd have some food on the hoof, as it were. And there were several shipwrecks, some of which were recorded that we know of, but it was only in 1609 when permanent settlement of Bermuda took place. And that was due to the Third Relief Fleet, which was on its way from England to Jamestown, Virginia. It was caught in a hurricane south of Bermuda, and the lead ship, the Sea Venture, a new ship, started leaking, and they were literally going to the bottom when the hurricane clears, and right in front of them was the eastern end of the island of Bermuda. They attempted to land on a beach, but they got stuck in one of the reefs a mile offshore. But everybody was saved, and 10 months later, miraculously, they appeared in Virginia.
The first known settlement on Bermuda may have come about by pure accident, But it wasn't long before this ordeal led to a more intentionally planned settlement of people on the island, largely as a way to service the first permanent settlement by the English in the Americas.
Well, originally, Bermuda was settled by the Virginia Company in 1612. So the shipwreck of the Sea Venture was 1609. And 3 years later, they decided to settle Bermuda with a full group of people and to make it an outpost for Jamestown. And indeed, when the shipwrecked mariners from Bermuda arrived in Virginia in May, June of 1610, our people from Bermuda were all suntanned and nice and fat from all the pigs and the fish and the wild birds and so on, whereas people at Jamestown were starving. Anyway, the Virginia Company decided to settle Bermuda in 1612, and so it has been permanently occupied since then. So these were largely people from England, later on some from Ireland. And then over the next few decades, Africans were introduced a lot via the West Indies. So they were already living in the West Indies or came first to the West Indies to slave markets there and then came to Bermuda, introducing the second large cultural group to Bermuda. And the population today is reflective of that.
According to Dr. Harris, enslaved Africans were introduced to Bermuda over the next few decades, mainly brought over from slave markets at established colonies in the West Indies. This eventually became the second largest cultural group and helped shape the population and culture of the island as it stands today. Let's turn back now to Dr. Christy Warren.
And then it stops being as important as the eastern seaboard develops, as other islands are settled. Some Bermudians, actually mostly of English descent, head down to the Caribbean to colonize other islands like St. Kitts, for instance, and then later Bahamas. So there's like different layers of colonization that they're involved in. But Bermuda becomes kind of a backwater. And that's something that we pick up in colonial correspondence as well, that it's not really important, but they still have to follow along with what London is dictating, which doesn't really suit Bermudians very well. Because, for instance, when the American Revolution starts, there's the idea that you need to show your loyalty to Britain by not trading with the rebels, you know, these people that are trying to overthrow British colonialism in the United States. They didn't stop. It's not surprising. They just found back doors. So again, we've got these different connections. Trade with Bermuda, you could also see the way, as I said, Bermudians would often do things through the back door, I would say. The word often used in Bermuda is privateer. Privateer is someone who is been given a letter of marque from the crown, in this case the British crown, which allows them to take the ships of enemies and whatever is on them. It was such a big business, they even had prize courts to determine if this was done legally. But some people continued attacking ships even when they didn't have the letter of marque, which meant they actually were pirates. And that was part of Bermuda's history as well. And some of that you can see if you kind of go to tourist spaces, there are pirate features. But it's interesting the kind of vision we have of pirates versus what pirates actually were, like the spectrum that we have, a range of people from all backgrounds who are kind of running away from society on one hand, including women. And then on the other hand, you have these gentlemen privateers, as they were called, who also acted as pirates. You wouldn't see them as the typical pirate, but they were.
Of course, as mentioned earlier by Dr. Harris, and just as with so many colonial settlements of centuries past, it did not take long for slavery to enter the picture. So what do we know about the first known enslaved person of African descent brought to Bermuda? And where did he come from?
He had to come from somewhere, right? He was already embroiled in the Atlantic world of forces that were greater than him. And he was accompanied by a Native American person who also was caught up in that same world.
The Atlantic world of forces that Dr. Warren is referring to includes, of course, the transatlantic slave trade introduced by the European powers as they established their presences in the Americas and the islands around them. And while the names of these two people, of respectively African and Native American descent, may not be known, it's important to recognize the labor they provided was forced, first likely by Spanish colonizers in Venezuela, then by British colonizers in Bermuda.
And the reason why I highlight the African person is it's believed he was the first African person to land based on documentation, and that was in 1616. Whereas the Native American man, the way he was written about, it suggests that Native American people were already there or at least had passed through. Both of their arrivals were important. I love Clarence Maxwell's work on early Bermuda when he talks about the communication between the kind of Portuguese imperial world, Spanish imperial world, and what was starting in Bermuda. And that although the British were trying very hard to differentiate themselves from the Spanish and Portuguese, they also wanted to kind of get ahead. The first ship of settlers comes through from England in 1612. And so for me, it's telling that it's only 4 years later that they realize we actually can't do this by ourselves. We don't know what we're doing here. We don't know this place. We don't understand how to grow things here. In the first 4 years, they were getting through quite a lot of the resources that were on the island. So when you look at what the governor is asking for, they send this expedition in 1616. There's a list of goods that they want to pick up. And the last thing I believe on the list is a person. So this person is identified as human, but they're listed with goods. They go to what was often called the Spanish Main. I believe Clarence Maxwell says it's potentially in present-day Venezuela.
Dr. Clarence Maxwell is, by the way, an assistant professor of history at Millersville University in Pennsylvania, who has written extensively about Bermuda.
And that's where this man is picked up, at least. Where he comes from originally, I don't know. And over the next few decades, of course, more and more Africans came. And that's where we get some of Clarence Maxwell's work around the fact that these people were coming not just to labor, which is what I was taught when I was growing up. The little bit we were taught about enslaved people. And that's no shade on my teachers. They weren't taught it either. In my thesis, I have work on colonial education. What were people actually taught? And it's very little. There was a book written by Anglican priests about the island's early settlement that ends in 1620. That was for school children. That was published in 1937.
That book, incidentally, is called Early History of Bermuda for Children and was written by an Anglican priest named Canon Arthur Tucker.
And it was used until the 1960s. And it is mainly, unsurprisingly, a top-down history. Governors did this. So there's very little about anybody from below, whether they're Black or Native American or those first English settlers, most of whom were not wealthy, that were coming to work the land of other people. And of course, we cannot forget the Irish and the Scottish, who were also being brought around that same time. So you've got this kind of mixture of people, but like elsewhere, very quickly, the idea becomes that a mass of people are needed for labor, but they're also needed for knowledge. And that's the bit that I wasn't taught about, and which Clarence shows very clearly in like looking at some of the architecture, for instance, in St. George's. That's the place I would start when I think about Bermudian history, is St. George's. The original House of Assembly met in a building that has echoes of architecture from parts of the Spanish and Portuguese Empire.
As we discuss the cultural mix of Bermuda, let's pause for a moment to recognize one of the unique traditional art forms of the island that rises from that cultural mix. Gombe is an iconic performance art tradition that includes colorful costumes and masks accompanied by dance and music. For more on this wonderful expression of Bermudian identity, let's now turn to Gary Phillips, a former director of tourism for the island.
The history of the Gombes is really the history of the movement of Black people into this portion of the diaspora from Africa. I think it was Jessica Harris who said that we all came on the same boat, we just made different stops. And with that stopping, we were not a naked people. In other words, we may not have had clothes on, but we did come with a culture. This is not something which just happened as we came across. We brought with us a culture, and that culture stuck in whatever port the boat stopped in. And so from a cultural perspective, as it relates to Bermuda, we see a number of ships that actually sailed from Bermuda and went directly to Africa and brought back slaves. Some stayed in Bermuda. Some went on to the Americas. But later on, we see the migration of blacks coming to Bermuda as strong laborers, technicians, sailors, and carpenters, all coming to help Bermuda develop its infrastructure. In particular, it starts really around about the middle to the end of the 19th century, 1880s, 1890s, where we see quite a strong migration of skilled laborers coming to Bermuda to develop the infrastructure, like the city of Hamilton, like the naval dockyard. And with them, of course, they brought their own culture.
Together, with the African influence already present on the island, this helped shape the art form we now know as the gombe.
So my grandparents, on my mother's side, my maternal grandparents, were actually born in St. Kitts and came to Bermuda around about the turn of that particular century. And they were so concerned and nostalgic about the culture that they were leaving that they began to revive and give voice, if you will, to something which they already found in Bermuda back in the 17th century.
According to Phillips, an 1835 book called Sketches of Bermuda offered a somewhat early portrait of the relevance of the gombe movement for the outside world. The book, a collection of letters and sketches by a visitor from England named Suzette Lloyd, among other things, portrayed a vibrant tradition that had, in part, migrated from Africa with the people brought to Bermuda under tyranny of enslavement. Furthermore, according to Phillips, it was a UNESCO Cultural and Conservation Conference held in Jamaica in 1970 that helped cement the reputation of the Bermudian gombe tradition as a unique phenomenon separate and different from the similarly named gombe dance form present in the Bahamas or those performed by so-called St. Kitts Indians in the West Indies. So what exactly makes the gombe tradition so unique?
The thing that was quintessentially unique about Bermuda was the music. One Bermudian composer, a blind composer by the name of Lance Hayward, actually was commissioned to transpose the music of the gombes because quite unlike what we saw in the Caribbean, we used the snare drum, which was part of the military influence on the development of the gombes, and a bass drum. If you look at the snare drum, most cultures in Africa don't use sticks in order to beat. They usually use their hands. And so it was declared, as I said, in 1976, that the musicality was unique to Bermuda. The dress, interestingly enough, is different in that because they were, in some instances, mimicking the slave masters, they felt the need to cover themselves completely. So you don't ever, in the traditional gombe, see who the person is that is dancing, because they would be exposed and therefore may have some kind of retribution by the slave masters. But it always falls back onto the fact that there was a heavy influence by other things which came in their way. I usually call this the ABC of gombe. The A meaning the American Indian influence, B meaning the British influence with the drumming, and C, of course, most importantly, especially for the modern gombe, we're talking about the Caribbean. I think the main thing that has changed a lot is the costuming. As we have become more affluent, you see the costume is becoming a lot more elaborate, a lot brighter. I remember as a child that the gombes were not as colorful as they are right now because the people didn't have the means to buy colorful beads and colorful fabrics in order to make the gombe costumes.
It's important to recognize, however, that though the gombe tradition is celebrated now, that was certainly not always the case.
In fact, there is a quotation which says something like, the persons who get involved in such a diabolical practice should be banned. If I can recall, it says, the savage and nonsensical exhibition of the gombe practiced here by the idle should be done away with as a thing not suited to a civilized community and highly dangerous to persons on horses or in carriages. That was written in 1837. So you can see already that the Gombe movement, the Gombe practice, the Gombe tradition was being suppressed. In fact, even in my lifetime, in order for the Gombes to dance in the open streets and not in the neighborhoods, for example, going into the city of Hamilton, they had to get a license. They had to go to the police department, get a license so that you could dance and perform in the streets. Otherwise, you had to stay in this imaginary area delineated by a particular street, and that was where they practiced and celebrated their culture and their craft. So what has happened now is that from the period of suppression to this period of almost celebration, I mean, the Gombes is almost ubiquitous now, if I might say that, because the Gombes appear almost everywhere. Everyone uses an occasion to invite the Gombes, whether it be at a funeral, whether it be at a christening, whether it be at a wedding, any conceivable reason to use the Gombes has given the Gombes a renaissance, if you will, that is really quite unprecedented and refreshing from my perspective. But I have to confess that having grown up in a family of Gombes, I took them for granted. And it was only when I was married and my wife came to Bermuda, and every Boxing Day, every New Year's Day, every Easter Monday, I would disappear and say, I'm off, bye. And off I would go to run with the Gombes. Well, she became a little bit concerned about this practice and decided, as a part of her anthropological paper and sociology degree from Queen's University in Canada, to do some research. And I have to confess that that is when I became interested in the historical value of the Gombes, because she began to show me, said, you're running with the Gombes, but you have no idea about the history of it. And so it was through her that I began to take a much closer look at the Gombe movement. And in fact, as a result of that work, we were invited, if I have to be honest, I think she was invited and I was invited to come along to celebrate the Gombes as a part of the Smithsonian Folklife Festival on the Washington Mall back in 2001.
We'll be back with more after the break. This episode of Lost Cultures Living Legacies from Travel and Leisure is brought to you by the Bermuda Tourism Authority. Where is Bermuda? This small but accessible archipelago, known for its pink sand beaches, is at the same latitude as Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, in the Atlantic Ocean. Visitors are embraced by Bermudians who love to share their deep cultural heritage, delicious cuisine, and the centuries-old cultural expression and tradition of the Gombes. The island's blend of Caribbean, British, West African, Native American, and Portuguese influences makes it an appealing place for travelers dreaming of something close yet luxurious. Whether you're seeking adventure, planning a family vacation, or simply looking to experience something new, Bermuda is the perfect destination for discovering an island rich in history, stories, and traditions. Visit gotobermuda.com for more information. I'm Alicia Prakash, and you're listening to Lost Cultures Living Legacies, a podcast from Travel and Leisure. Let's return now to the wider cultural mix that historically defines Bermuda. It's worth noting here that as far as the British are concerned, the transatlantic slave trade was abolished in 1807. Furthermore, slavery itself was abolished throughout the empire in 1833, though full emancipation did not come until 5 years later in 1838. Now, back to Dr. Ed Harris.
And so, at that time, you then had two main cultural groups in Bermuda, partly from Africa, partly from Northern Europe. And then because of a turndown in the boat building industry because steam was coming and wooden ships that were made so well in Bermuda, powered by the Bermuda rig, which is now world famous. Every yacht in the world carries a Bermuda rig, which is invented at Bermuda. We went looking for other people to develop agriculture in Bermuda. And so people were brought in from Madeira to begin with, and then largely from the Azores. And so the third major population group in Bermuda are from Portuguese descent from the Azores. And that still continues today. In recent decades, quite a few Filipinos have married into the local population. And so that adds another cultural gloss to the Bermuda cake mix, if you will. Of course, as you know, and I'm sure your programs point out, we are all exposed to the internationalism of the internet and other outside influences.
Because of its place in the world as an island far from any continent, maritime development and the culture that accompanied it played vital roles in how Bermuda developed. But it's also important to recognize the place of women in Bermudian history. To explain this, Dr. Warren also emphasized the role of both onions and poisonous substances.
So they tried to grow tobacco. It didn't go well. Bermuda's soil, at least traditionally said, wasn't suitable for growing tobacco. And the narrative is that we switched to a maritime economy, which is true, but it doesn't kind of include what women were doing, especially enslaved women. So enslaved women were still working the land. And there's a wonderful book called Mind the Onion Seed by Nellie Musson, which is really hard to get a hold of, but it's beautiful and it's inspirational. So we've got this question of mining the onion seed. And what does that mean? It means the onion was one of the most important exports of Bermuda. And it was women who took care of them. It was women who made sure the seeds didn't get eaten. It was women that made sure that they grew. It was women that made sure they got picked. So back to Clarence, because he's written work around one of our most amazing historical figures, Sally Bassett. She was accused of poisoning the enslavers of her granddaughter. One of the things I love about her story, it's a story about rebellion against slavery, and it was, but it was also interpersonal. She was a human being. So there's a backstory to that, where she had been accused years before of witchcraft, of causing animals to die. And it turns out it was the same family years later that she ends up getting accused of trying to poison, including an enslaved person in the house. A lot of times when we talk about slavery, we forget that these were all human beings. And Sally's story, both what's in the archive and the stories that have been passed down through oral history, show her as a human being.
Let's turn back now to Dr. Harris on how the course of United States history helped to shape the development of Bermuda.
I think if we look at it from a cultural viewpoint of the outside world, there's several significant events in the history of Bermuda. One, of course, is the settlement, and then the coming of two groups of populations, and then the development of Bermuda's maritime trade, where we built our own ships here in Bermuda Cedar, and we traveled the western seas, if you will, from the Caribbean north to Halifax. If you turn a map on its side and Bermuda's in the center, then you're looking at a fan in front of you from the northern tip of South America up to Greenland, and this was the scope for Bermudians in the maritime trades. Now, this did very well for a long time, particularly when the Royal Navy became interested in Bermuda sloops, which were the fastest thing afloat, and purchased quite a few of them from Bermuda. So the maritime trade was very significant for everyone.
According to Dr. Harris, the crews of many ships were made up of enslaved black people and run by white enslavers. Despite this power dynamic, though, many of the enslaved crew members were allowed to trade on their own behalf.
So there was an interchange of cultural artifacts, if you will, right across the society. But then, of course, came the great changing point, which was the American Revolutionary War. Bermuda, while sympathetic generally speaking, to the ideas of the what became the United States, did not join in the revolution. And I have to say, we probably profited off of it as we did during the American Civil War and, in fact, during the two world wars. But the importance of the American Revolutionary War was that the British military, who previously had no interest in Bermuda — Bermuda was a company town until 1674. It was then taken over by the British government, and then sent out their own governors. But they weren't interested in it because they had all these possessions and all the harbors on the eastern coast of what became the United States. When the United States went to independence, they appreciated Bermuda was right in the middle of a defensive line that went from Halifax in the north to the British Islands in the West Indies. And so Bermuda became the linchpin in controlling, maritime speaking, the new United States. And so the imaginary border of Britain, if you will, was moved 700 miles offshore from the new United States to Bermuda, Halifax, and the West Indies.
This marked a huge turning point for Bermuda. Before the American Revolution, the island had only small, settler-built fortifications. But afterward, the full force of the British military moved in, pouring money into Bermuda and constructing massive defenses, including forts at the eastern end of the island, as well as the Great Royal Naval Dockyard at the western end.
So this was an incredibly significant event in the history of Bermuda, because in my view, the military money underlay the wealth of Bermuda today. And it was then that this money poured into Bermuda, and it did not go to the West Indies as it had done before when we were fighting with the French. That is to say, the British were fighting with the French. So a very, very significant event which brought this huge influx of money and work throughout the community.
So with the American Revolution, American War of Independence, take your pick, Bermuda once again becomes important. That geographical location, kind of almost smack dab in the middle of the continent, becomes important as a space to link colonies in what is now Canada with colonies throughout the Caribbean. And that is for trade, but also defense. So the Royal Navy Dockyard gets built as a bulwark. And it's used. It's used sometimes preventatively in the early 20th century. There was a Mexican war and a ship was sent from Bermuda and was off the coast of Mexico just in case British people needed to get out. But ships were also sent from Bermuda down to Jamaica when they were trying to quell uprisings. This is an important kind of space. It's not the only one, of course. There were Navy garrisons across the Caribbean, but this idea of, yeah, trade and defense kind of brings Bermuda back to life a bit.
And then came the abolition of slavery in the 1830s, which meant that everybody was on an equal footing from that point of view, a basic equal footing, not on voting rights or anything like that. But that was a significant change as well. And then came the American Civil War, and Bermuda profited greatly for that because, being in its geographical position in the center of the Western Atlantic facing the United States and nearest to the Southern Confederate States, Bermuda became an entrepot or a transfer of places for guns and munitions and things like perfume and what have you, coming in from Europe, being transshipped into the Confederacy on these specially built boats called blockade runners, of which we have several in Bermuda, which are marvelous viewing sites in the water. In Bermuda, you have these glorious open museums under the water. So that was another significant event. And probably the last very significant event was the Second World War. The reason for it was that Britain was almost bankrupt during the Second World War, so the Americans took over the defense of Bermuda, and they also put bases in Nova Scotia and in the West Indies. So the coast of America, if you will, the imaginary defensive coast of Bermuda came 700 miles to sea plus air cover. For the American, the really significant event at the end of the war was the fact that during the war, an airfield was built at Bermuda. This caused a tremendous upset in the eastern end of Bermuda because a lot of people had to give up their homes and properties. This meant that at the end of the war, unlike many other islands, Bermuda had a military airfield for civilian tourism by plane. And this is incredibly significant and led to what's referred to as the Golden Age in Bermuda tourism, that is to say, airplane tourism. And that airfield was maintained right up to the end of the Cold War by your tax dollars, I'm pleased to say. And it also brought my mother to Bermuda, which maybe wasn't such a good thing, but there we are.
We asked our guests to talk about the ongoing living legacy of Bermuda and how travelers can responsibly interact with the island, its culture, and its history. First, let's turn to Dr. Harris.
Cultural influences come and go. Some of them stay. Some of them you change and make into your own, and then you export those. There are, for example, Bermuda architecture forms in the Turks and Caicos Islands, of which we're very proud. Now, in Bermuda, if you ask me, what is to be a Bermuda, and I would point to a Bermuda house above all else, because that, as an archaeologist, I'm more interested in the material culture than, say, the natural world, although I'm interested in it. But it's growing up around your culture that inculcates in you unconsciously a sense of belonging, which is terribly important. The main problems in societies arise from a sense of not belonging. And so if you scratch a Bermudan, you'll find someone who's very proud of Bermudian culture in whatever form they happen to be interested in. But overall, it's the present landscape and it's the buildings on the landscape which provide the anchor, because transient culture changes. It's the main reason why people travel, is to learn about different places, and they do that through the tangible culture of the place. And so that's why it's terribly important to preserve things for the future. We're only trustees, we're only passing through for a short time, but I can tell you many people who visit Bermuda become Bermudophiles for the rest of their lives. It's just a magic that the place has, that many other places have. We don't have this as an exclusive, but it becomes an exclusive when we say this is Bermuda, this is Bermuda culture. This belongs to us, but I'm delighted to share it with you.
Bermuda's living legacy is its people. I think we're pretty special. There aren't many of us in the world, and we seem to be able to punch above our weight. We show up in all sorts of areas of life. And across the world, Bermudians come from all sorts of backgrounds. It's a real place with real people that have a range of struggles and joys. But yes, we are Bermuda's living legacy, we Bermudians.
It is critical for particularly our young people to understand that things just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. People fought hard. I know it's a cliche, but we stand on the shoulders of so many people who worked hard to create this culture. And if we don't celebrate it, I mean, where are we? Where are we? As a very small speck in the Atlantic, 600-700 miles off the coast of North Carolina, an hour and a half from New York by airplane, and a day and a half by cruise ship, it can easily be overlooked as an insignificant piece of geography. But Bermuda has played an enormous part in geopolitics. I think one of the first places that I would always suggest a visitor needs to start is in the town of the old town of St. George's. It has the oldest parliament in the Western Hemisphere. St. Peter's Church is there. The King's Chapel is in that space. It's a very old edifice, very little electricity. You can see where the slaves were required, if they wished to worship. They couldn't worship in the main part of the church. You still have a section of the graves of the graveyard where the blacks were allowed to be buried. And then there was a wall separating them from the Caucasian communities. But the town itself, which has incidentally become a World Heritage Site. So yes, I would ask people to start in St. George's, because that is where you get the real sense of how Bermuda started.
I would say to get the best out of St. George's would be to connect with Long Story Short, which is run by Kristen White, and she runs award-winning tours. It's an amazing bookshop. There are also cultural events that happen there. So it's a space to connect both with the past and the present of Bermuda, which I think is great. In St. George's as well, I mean, everybody likes some nice food. I particularly love seafood. And when it's lunchtime, I don't like fussy things. I just want it to be good. I want it to be easy. I want to feel comfortable. And so when I'm in St. George's, I like to go to Wahoo's and eat a fish lunch.
There are almost 400 shipwrecks at Bermuda, so it's a scuba diver's paradise. And artifacts of the shipwrecks are displayed at several museums in Bermuda. At the National Museum of Bermuda, we have war clubs, probably from Guyana in South America, that are unique. They were preserved on a shipwreck, and they've survived into the present day because they were built of some of those hard South American woods, timbers. When we move into the land, of course, Bermuda is highly developed, but there are still many public parks, a lot of which came from British military lands that they bought off the general public for their forts and other things, which are now part of our national parks. And then we have all the fortifications, but most of them occupy wonderful sites in terms of vistas, because they had to be up on the coast in order to shoot at ships. And then you have the buildings and lands belonging to the Bermuda National Trust, which preserve about 70 historic homes and properties, some of which are opened to the public. Now, when it comes to transient culture, if you will, by that I mean things that you can pick up and move, we do have several wonderful art galleries containing paintings and drawings and sketches and other sculpture by Bermudians or by people visiting Bermuda, and things have been acquired and been brought back to Bermuda. So it's an art lover's paradise as well.
From St. George's, I would actually go to the opposite side of the island. There's a ferry you can catch, which cuts down the time significantly to get from one side of the island to the other. Bermuda's small, and we have one car per household rule, but we still get traffic. So if you can avoid it on the ferry, it's quite nice. And that takes you to the Royal Naval Dockyard. So that's the space that was built to defend empire. And it's a key site in Atlantic world history. And the whole of the Royal Dockyard is history. All the buildings are kind of oozing history. But the key place is the Commissioner's House, which houses the National Museum of Bermuda, where it's possible to learn more about Bermudians of all different backgrounds, how we all ended up on the island, what different groups of people brought with them, and how people are kind of keeping that legacy alive. Like, what does it mean to be Bermudian is my question, but it can also be, what does it mean to be a Bermudian of African descent? What does it mean to be Bermudian of Portuguese descent? What does it mean to be Bermudian of European descent, for instance? And all of that is kind of explored at that museum. And my favorite space in the museum is called the Hall of History, unsurprisingly. It is a mural which covers 500 years of human history on the islands. It was researched, designed, and painted by Bermudian artist Graham Foster. And it winds down a large, I believe it's Bermuda cedar, but it winds down a large staircase. I mean, some of the information that Graham has included in picture form, I definitely didn't learn in school, but it is in the curriculum now, and it's really lovely to see that we're acknowledging how a range of different people contributed to what Bermuda is today.
Thank you to our guests, Dr. Christy Warren, Dr. Ed Harris, and Gary Phillips. Be sure to follow Lost Cultures Living Legacies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'd love your feedback. If you could, please rate this podcast and leave us a review. We'd greatly appreciate it. You can also find us online at travelandleisure.com/lostcultures. Enjoy your travels. Lost Cultures Living Legacies is a production of Travel and Leisure and Dot Dash Meredith. I'm your host, Alicia Prakash, Associate Editorial Director at Travel and Leisure. Lottie Lamarie is our executive producer. Jeremiah Lee McVeigh is our writer and producer. Michael Onufrak is our audio engineer and editor. Our fact checker for this episode was Jessica Rubel, and it was reviewed by Mackenzie Menno, a panelist on Dot Dash Meredith's Anti-Bias Review Board. Thanks also to Mackenzie Price, Director of Anti-Bias Initiatives. The theme song for Lost Cultures Living Legacies is a piece called Beneath the Stars, which is composed by Joshua Specht. Nina Ruggiero is Digital Editorial Director for Travel and Leisure.